I felt the same thing when I was playing Telfight during my testing stuff too, which is just, you can just feel the fact that somebody was having fun making it.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the game is having fun and it doesn't really care whether you are. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 271 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I make websites.
I'm Sam and I write all the words and stuff.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is August 7th, 2020. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show. There's going to be some swears, so just be prepared for that. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We grabbed your money. Thanks for letting us do that.
It's nice.
We have a little bit of a lag thing, so there may be a little bit more interruptions in this episode than, you know, normal.
A lot of which there's normally a shitload.
So, yeah. I think Adam's like 2 whole seconds behind us right now for some reason. So we're doing our best over here. This work from home thing is really a pickle. All right. Now I got a quick question for you guys. Something I need to figure out. Here's the deal. About 2.5 months ago, I was at the grocery store. I needed cream soda. You ever get that feeling that you just really, really need cream soda?
I have had that in the past, but it ends in a very particular way, which is what I'm curious about once you drank one.
Okay. So I was going down the aisle and I was like, got to get my cream soda on. I snagged some of the A&W, you know,
classic
top shelf cream soda. Got it home, realized that I had thought I was getting the diet cream soda. Okay. But I got the real cream soda, the 48 grams of sugar per 12 ounce can cream soda. So I started drinking one of them and I couldn't do it. So after about one gulp, I just poured it out. Mm-hmm. So I've had 11 cans of cream soda, just kind of hanging out in my house for like 2.5 months now. And I was just wondering if you guys had any ideas on what am I supposed to do about this?
I'm in a similar pickle because Diane and I recently got into drinking like fizzy water, right? So you're like, was it La Croix, whatever the fizzy stuff is called. So it's lightly flavored. It's just fizzy carbonated water, right? So we happen to order, as we do, you know, with a little bit of extra chaos every few orders. And so Diana got these ones called Izzy's, which are apparently actually like a juice plus carbonated beverage. So the problem is, so the cans are tiny, right? It's sort of like – it's one of those skinny cans. So I think it's like eight ounces. And there's like 20 grams of sugar in this thing, okay? So I started drinking one of them, had the exact same response. I drank half of it and then I was like, I cannot. And the problem was because we ordered, we thought we were going to, you know, we've been drinking a ton of these. So she ordered like a big case of them. So we just have them. Mm-hmm. They're taking up like two side shelves in our fridge are just like lined with these Izzy's. And we haven't figured out what to do with them either.
I've got a solution for Izzy's, but not for root beer because – With a fruity, like a fruity, fizzy, sugary thing, perfect for cocktails. Make cocktails, do it every once in a while until those things are gone. It's perfect. Because a cocktail, you need some booze, you need some sugar, and you need some other flavor. And with a sugary beverage, you've got two of the three. Just slap some booze in there. It'll be great.
So I've only got peanut butter whiskey, though. So I don't know.
Will be really gross. Which is actually, you're in the opposite problem that Seth is in, which is I know he has lots of good booze, but a terrible mixer because cream soda is going to be fucking disgusting.
Wait. Trade. If you mixed peanut butter whiskey with cream soda,
it's probably great.
That might work.
That would probably work.
All right. We got to figure out some kind of sort of hostage trade move. Some kind of social distancing delivery of my cream soda and your fizzy fruit drink. And
for your worst case scenario.
Or vice versa.
You can get some Mentos and then just have a Mentos party. Just shoot that shit all over the place.
Yeah, it's in a can though. So I got to figure out how to package it, repackage it into bottles so that you can create a proper Mentos cream soda cannon situation.
Oh, you want to make a bomb?
No, you got to make it. You got to make it like shoot out like a, you know, like a squirt gun. Mm-hmm. But the opening of a can is all fucked up and it's not going to – you can't aim that.
That's true.
You know?
That's where powdered Mentos comes in. You know? You got to take it to the next level if you're engineering one of these solutions.
It's true. But anyway, I've still got 11 cans. I got plenty of opportunities to try some things out. So we'll have to see what happens. Let's talk about the studio. Where are we at with the tech debt burned down rodeo circus? Well – we've got Rumpus integrated into all of the games.
Every single one of them.
Tile Fight, Roid Rage, Flop Rocket, Quadrupus, Crashlands, Levelhead, of course, because that was already the case. We don't have them ready to release yet. We still have some final bits and bobs to work out, as well as of course testing, which is a new thing that we're doing that we didn't do back when we first made those games.
Which has been funny because I've seen the bug reports coming in for Crashlands on our to-do board. Turns out there's a considerable number in there.
Yeah. There's some.
Who would have thunk it?
Some of which are new because of the changes. Some of which have been there for, 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's okay. But it's been pretty fun to play Tile Fight 2. And for those of our listeners who haven't played Tile Fight 2, it's free. So just go get it. Get it on Android or iOS because we made this game. This was the first game that we made as a full-time studio. And it is an incoherent, wild time.
It's like a fever dream, isn't it? Like just –
it is. I mean nothing about it makes any kind of sense. Like there's a – at some point you rescue this floating head – magician, which for some reason we called him a magician. I think because he has a bag.
He does. He uses a bag to do magic, so he's a magician.
He's a magician. A magician. He's got a bag. His name's Tim, and he casts spells on you. So you can give him coins, and he casts spells. But the spells are essentially like pieces of art ripped from our jam games that we just like put in there. So like one of them is like an actual full on character from a jam game that we made. This big beefy yellow guy from a game called I Know CPR, where like there's a man having a series of heart attacks and you have to defibrillate him.
So that comes – how does that come into play? Do you become – I don't even remember this at all. Do you become that character or
– No, it's like you
– Probably orbits.
You pay – Tim, the magician, and he casts this spell on you, and now that picture of that large yellow man is now just like orbiting your body, and it conveys some kind of effect onto you. There's one of the spells is called the Five Phone, where it's an iPhone, and it has a screenshot of Tile Fight 2 stuck in portrait mode on the phone.
To celebrate the iPhone 5 fiasco where it got stuck in portrait mode?
Yeah. Because when we launched the game, the iPhone 5 came out like around that same time. And we didn't have an iPhone 5 to test on. We only had an iPhone 4. And it turned out that it was handling portrait mode differently. And all of our iPhone 5 players launched the game stuck in portrait mode. And it looked so stupid because the game was really tiny in the middle. And then there was like these huge, tall, vertical controls on the side. And so someone sent us a screenshot of that being like, this looks weird. And then we took that screenshot, put it onto an item in the game as a phone item, gave that spell to Tim the magician, and then the description was that like it's highly reflective screen allows you to send damage back to enemies. Also, it's stuck in portrait mode, and so it's like a damage reflect thing. So it's basically like we in Tile Fight 2. We had ideas of stuff we wanted to do, and then we just did them.
Yep.
Sort of without any regard to making it make sense in the world of the game or even mechanically making it make much sense.
Is there the – is the launch chili in there?
There's launch chili.
Yeah.
Which it's spicy, so it gives you an extra like attack speed or something.
That's because I was making chili the day that we launched the game. So we decided
was
to put
making
that
chili. He was making chili on launch day. And so we put that in the game. Like, yes. Why? And it's called Launch Chili.
I think that was in a place in a while, episode, wasn't it? Like at the very beginning?
I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah, one of the beginning ones. Yeah, but I think it's one of those funny things where I haven't actually played. Maybe I'll do that this weekend. Just take a stroll down memory lane. But
and there's so much happening in that game. At the time I was playing, so my cloud save is still there because Beastcotch ID, despite being an ancient piece of crap, surprisingly resilient. So I loaded it up and my cloud save just came right down. And I was like partway through the third and final section of the game, which is called Horrible Nightmare Land.
Isn't it just made of flesh and bones?
It's just like made gross of meat.
Yeah.
And so I'm in Horrible Nightmare Land. And the projectiles that I'm using is like, I've got the puffer fish. So it like just dunks on the ground and it just blasts out spines. I've got praying mantises, which orbit you and then like smash and explode. I've got chainsaws, which are alive. And then they
this orbit
around you. Yep. I got the turtle shell to protect myself. I've got the ant, which digs and fills in holes. Like it's a... And so all of these things are just like I walk into a room. I can't see anything. I've got like 90 projectiles coming out of my face. There's enemies flying everywhere. There's lasers. Every time you hit something, random words come out of it. So you can't see the thing that you're shooting. And it's still weirdly fun.
Yeah. I remember one of my favorite reviewers has this term called rainbow vomit, which is sort of trying to encapsulate that effect that happens in a lot of games where as things just ramp up, you keep on stacking all these effects and stacking these powers and stuff. And at some point, you just can't tell what the hell is going on. It's just like a disco ball just flying around, which is the same thing we got there.
But I mean, despite all of that, or perhaps because of all of that, it still holds up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a wild fun time. So definitely check it out. You know, we're also going to be updating it soon with Rumpus and deploying all that, but the core gameplay will be the same. So, and also all of your old progress from the legacy version will transfer to the new version. So you don't lose anything.
There's an interesting question there, I think, which is one of both of nostalgia of, dev nostalgia. So going back to a time where you just did whatever. Literally whatever, with no regard for consequence. It sort of feels like childhood in a sense.
Totally.
Which, Adam, I don't know if you get this with looking back at your Beastcotch ID stuff since you've been refactoring a lot too. Just sort of the level of just kind
whimsy.
Of whimsical
there's less
creation
of a degree of gleeful abandon because with Beastcotch ID it's just made poorly. Like that's its whole thing, right? Which is different than the sort of absurdist gleeful abandon that you get in Talfight 2, where it really is just doing whatever you want, and not in the way where we say without regards to consequences, like I'm going to code this in a shitty way and not worry about my future self having to deal with it, but more of I had this completely absurd idea and I want to have it exist, so I'm going to have it exist. But just period. There's no without any worry about. Are there consequences to this existing? Is this good? Is anybody going to understand what the hell this is? Because even the whole like the iPhone joke, right? And if you think about how many of those things are just jokes about our existing franchise, right? Which at that point nobody knew about. we just didn't care. It was clearly there for us, and then for our handful of fans who actually knew what we were up to. And if we think about these days, when we're thinking about adding stuff in and we're thinking about calling back to other games, those kind of stuff, the most common question we have is like, will anybody even notice or like care that we're doing this? And we focus on doing everything for the user, not just because we think it would be fun.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think that's a very good point about the orientation change. Went away from just making it because it felt fun to make for us to trying to make it for other people. But I do think there's a certain amount of magic that you can feel in something that is built that where someone was almost purely just having a real good time for themselves.
you could just feel it. Yeah. I felt the same thing when I was playing Telfight during my testing stuff too, which is just you can just feel the fact that somebody was having fun making it.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the game is having fun and it doesn't really care whether you are.
That is unfortunately about that's the tagline for Talfight right there. I just remember
whether you like it or not, fun. It likes itself.
Yeah. We put in the head recoil because you're wearing this monocle that shoots at animals. And we put head recoil in.
Yep.
So your character's head is constantly snapping backward like a bird, you know,
like a whiplash.
I remember we put that in and I was like, I mean, this is super weird, but it needs to be in there because it just feels so good.
So there you are. And then we gave you a pet pug and then it gets abducted and horribly morphed into a demon.
Hey, I mean, don't spoil it.
We also have it's been out for a while now. even one of the bosses is Gerblin, which is from our game Gerblins, mm-hmm. which like 18 people downloaded.
I think we had 30,000 people play that because we even wrote up an old blog post about it. You remember that? We wrote up a blog post back in our youth called How Piracy Saved Gerblins. And it was all about how people just stole it and therefore 30,000 people played it and therefore it was saved. You know, like the logic was a little convoluted.
Well, I mean, it's not totally wrong in the sense that it was up. We had a version of it that was up for free, which almost mm-hmm. nobody downloaded. And then we had a paid version, which almost nobody bought. And then 30,000 people played the game anyway, which at that time it was like, well, I mean, at least people are playing our game.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty fun to kind of go back and see. And my hope is that, you know, when we kind of relaunch these games with Rumpus and with some of them are getting some, you know, minor visual updates here and there just some like – general bug fixing and stuff, and in some cases like Quadrupus and Roid Rage, they're getting their resolution increased on the phone, so it'll look a little sharper and better. So I'm hoping that some of our old players get to go back and re-experience mm-hmm. a lot of those old games because they're going from something that we're kind of like we were trying to avoid making eye contact with because they were just in such rough shape to something once again that we are proud of having in our portfolio. So I'm very excited about that. We also launched the Levelhead patch this week and it went very smoothly except for one minor problem, which is that we accidentally introduced a bug that made it so that guests couldn't play through the tutorial. but
aside from that one, and by guests we mean people who have not signed in.
Yeah. So we were able to get that fixed and deployed on every platform except for Switch, which is still currently going through the certification process. But it was such a small change. It was 18 characters of code. Mm-hmm. That was the difference between people being able to play through the tutorial and not being able to play through it.
Yeah.
So – you know, it's going to go through cert. It'll be fine. It'll be out soon. But also if you are one of those people who's stuck playing as a guest, or who can't go through the tutorial as a guest, just log in to Rumpus and then
easy fix.
The
launch was very smooth. I think it was one of those things we debated about whether or not to put a trailer together, largely because trailers take a lot of time, to do. And we just weren't certain on if they would assist actually in terms of either securing featuring, anything else. And so we were like, well, let's just do our usual goofy blog post thing. Try just this non-trailer approach because if we can – basically it's the question of if we can get away with it, then it's just a much cheaper overall operation. And I will say like on the marketing side, as far as just how many things you have to worry about handling for press, blog posts and all this, when you don't have a trailer involved, the complexity – was like halved. I'm not even kidding. Halved. Because there's every single platform has – you have to do a specific trailer cut for that one, et cetera, et cetera. It's like even if you build the trailer, it doesn't stop being a source of pain in a lot of ways. And so it was very smooth. It was crazy smooth. We were just working on Wednesday. So it's really nice.
Yeah. And one thing people tend to not think about is when you have a game that's on – I mean we talked about this a little bit when we were first launching the game, how – for example, we needed we had 8 different stores that we were putting the game on in 11 languages, and we needed 5 or more screenshots per platform, right? So people would stop and think like, holy shit, we need nearly 1,000 screenshots of this game. And the same thing applies to trailers, right? Like we need localization where possible. We need to have it be – we call it like nativized for the store, so it needs to show the correct control overlays. It needs – and it can't refer to other platforms. So we can't like put a trailer up on the Switch – that shows like, no, it's on Steam. Like we can't do that.
I mean, even the controls bit is an easy one not to be aware of. If you're making a game, you're going to deploy on, say, like console and PC, right? It's your first time making a game and you got your trailer. I would put even money that you didn't actually think about the question of what buttons are being shown on the screen and whether it's showing, you know, characters from a keyboard or mouse clicks, you know, mouse buttons, or whether it's showing a cursor on a platform that doesn't have cursors like mobile. And then once you get cross console, it gets even weirder because they're all controllers, but then they have different characters for each button. And then when you get onto Switch and you can take the Switch controls apart. And so the whole thing becomes this really interesting problem of, do you make screenshots or trailers for each independent platform? Or what do you do? I guess since we've done this, the way that we did it for the trailers, we just said, okay, we can't localize it. That's just too costly. And we can't make a different version for every platform, at least as much as possible we can't, because that's too costly. So what we can do is make a way to have the interface be generic enough that you don't actually notice like stuff about which platform it's on, because we take away all the button indicators and all that kind of stuff so that it just works for everything.
And we did get some pushback on, for example, like the mobile platforms, because in some cases we're showing like a little hand
cursor
on screen. And our response is like, well, if you're playing with a controller on mobile, then that cursor is there.
Which made it possible.
Okay, fine.
Otherwise, we would have had to recapture like a good chunk of the trailers, which would have been a tremendous pain in the ass and expense on top of everything else.
I mean, it's pretty crazy just how much of a logistical challenge it is to manage all this stuff. Like it's, you know, we've said in the past that like the hardest part of game dev is not making the game. It's literally every other thing around the business side of it. So it's and a lot of it is these logistics. So this time we thought, let's see what happens if we don't make a trailer. See if it still lands well, and we can, you know, take that extra time and put it into other stuff. So we got our cool blog post. Tons of new features in this patch. People are apparently pretty blown away by how much stuff there is. We're getting a pretty good comments in Discord. So that's very exciting. And last bit of studio news for this week is we're going to talk about this thing we probably didn't invent the concept, but we did invent the word, as far as we know, which is the vertical slice.
Yes. There's an idea in games production called a vertical slice. And the idea here is you take a whole game design, which oftentimes has a ton of different layers to it. So if you think about a game as a lasagna, okay? It's delicious. It's the whole pan, right?
Yeah.
But if you just want to get a taste of that lasagna, you're not here to serve it yet. You know, you just want to get a taste to see if it's worthy of being served. Then you can just take a little slice of it, right? Just take a little slice out, a vertical slice, if you will. So you get a little bit of every single layer. You don't need all of it, but just a little bit. And that way you can actually see and feel what the game is essentially, and then make a call as to whether this is a good enough game lasagna to serve to your audience, right?
Yeah, you think to yourself, I mean, now that I've had a little sliver of this, I got the cheese, I got the noodles, I got the sauce, I got the beef, whatever's in that lasagna. And now you know whether you're prepared to eat the whole pan in one sitting.
Absolutely.
Right?
And so when you're going to deal with publishers or even platforms to some degree, that's also kind of like what a demo is, right? You basically oftentimes have to become prepared, coming into it prepared with a vertical slice such that people can figure it out. So again, this is our first time doing pre-production very purposefully. And so one of the ideas we came up with was we don't have the resources currently as far as just everything we have on our plate to actually build like a vertical slice. nor are we at the point where we would want to do that because there's still plenty of open-ended questions. And so the idea was, what if we – I mean, you could tell stories with just a bunch of text. So what if we essentially wrote out as a story the first hour or so of gameplay? And that's down to the details of where does the player go? What's showing up on screen? Who are they talking to? What's this play experience like? Yada, yada. And so we basically did that, and we talked about it as of this morning. And what did you guys – where were you at as far as – where you were at before on the understanding of the vision of the project versus now? And how do you see that vertical slice kind of playing into it?
So this is talking about Crashlands 2.
Correct.
It was super interesting, and it helped a lot. Another nice thing was throwing some music in there. So Sam wrote up the vertical slice and then put some references to like YouTube videos that just had like timestamped links to spots in the music, which is like, you know, this – I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm not going to say what actually happens yeah. right in the game, but it's like, okay, this thing starts to happen and it looks crazy and it's epic. And then like music like this starts, and then you click on the link and then you start to hear like – right. So as you're reading through it, you kind of get like – this really strong vibe about what you would be experiencing as the player, what your motivations are, try to imagine like how the jokes would land and also just like how the mechanics and concepts of the game get unspooled and introduced to the player. And I think it also revealed, some not holes in the design in like a bad way, but just blind spots, right? Like things that we had
I would call them blurry spots. There's things we know, but we haven't sharpened enough focus on to really be able to see what's going on there.
Yeah.
Well, especially things that you think you know, as in like you've got this like vague sense of what the thing is going to be, and so you feel like you don't need to worry about it because you're like, well, like it's going to kind of be like I've got an idea for what it's going to look like, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But as soon as you have to explicitly articulate the entirety of it, like that is the process by which you discover the actual, like the real problems that are going to get in there. And there were already a few that we noted going through this part. I think what Sam would probably, I think the one thing that we also noticed about just like the process itself was that it was very easy to fall into just telling a story and not getting those details, because when you're doing it as a vertical slice, then you're just focused on the talking, right? So you end up just like focusing on the dialogue and the character interactions, and then it becomes easy to not get into the weeds of the player walks into a room. The room has these things in it, spaced, you know, in this kind of a manner. And if the player now has these options of which things it can interact with, if they interact with that thing, which looks like this, then these are the possible things that could happen and blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Cause it becomes kind of endless in a way, right. To do it that way. And it goes from being really interesting when it's storytelling to really kind of dry when it's sort of trying to,
it's a technical document.
Yeah, it becomes a technical document in that case. And so finding a way to tell a story, which is supposed to be conveying like the player experience, which is supposed to be interesting, in a way that also gets at the details is an interesting challenge to get to them explicitly enough to have all of your questions be surfaced so that they can be answered while still being interesting and actually conveying it as if it's the gameplay experience itself.
Yeah, I think my favorite thing about it so far has been that every time we've done one of these larger feedback rounds on sort of a more complete feeling slice of this thing, every single time, then we've ended up cutting stuff, which to me is like so good, because if you guys – I don't know if you guys recall with Levelhead, but like there were so many concepts on the table when we started building that thing that we actually started – I mean we've talked about this in podcasts. Like we built an overworld for that game. For fuck's sake, like before we didn't think any further besides like, you know, it'd be really cool if there was an overworld and you battled people like in Pokemon with their levels. But for some reason we didn't. It kind of blows my mind, honestly, because like I feel like if we sat down and like went through the reality of what that would mean at the end of the day as far as development would go, then it almost should have been clear before we started even putting a line.
Well, this is the problem of purely iterative design. We actually have a question about this too, which we'll hit. But with purely iterative design, it's very easy to be hand wavy. So when we're talking about the vertical slice, like there's a section of the vertical slice where like it tells this very detailed story about what the player's doing. And then there's a sudden part where it's like the player runs around, fights some stuff, crafts some things.
Yeah, yeah.
And then goes back to talk to the NPC, right? And it's like, yeah, but like that's the game.
Yeah, what does that look like?
That's the gameplay, right? Yeah. And it's so easy to, as Adam was saying, it's so easy to think that you know what that's going to look like and just move on without actually pinning down the details. So that same kind of thing happened like when we were working on Levelhead is we were already in the middle of building the game and we had all of those pressures on us of continuing to deliver new actually implemented features, getting those things tested and all that stuff. And that meant that it was – it made it very easy for us to say like, okay, here's how this is going to work roughly. Okay, let's just start building it because we know
what it's going to be like. We'll figure the rest out as we actually and I think it's oftentimes – and I think it's a difference between your experience as a designer because I think as you get more experience as a designer, I think you can hold off on building things for longer. You know what I mean? Like if you can get into these more accurate, essentially just verbal – simulations about what the experience is going to be, then you should be able to hold off longer before you need to commit to code, right? Versus when you start out, honestly, like it's not a bad idea to just be like, we need to quit talking about this because we can't even – I don't understand how this is going to work and I don't think we could talk about it until we do, right? Which I think is true early on in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
But later on, certainly, once you got some titles under your belt, it's totally possible to – what was the joke? There's a joke in one of Clay's GDC talks about programming for 3 weeks to save yourself from having a 1 hour conversation.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Which is about what this feels like.
Yeah. It goes both ways.
Yeah.
Some things can be prototyped in 10 minutes to save a 3 hour conversation. And some things can in a 3 hour conversation save you 3 months.
Yeah. But when it comes to global design, it's going to be always a case that it's cheaper to talk it through and work the problem through using other means besides like full on
code,
because there are too many things that all have to come together. There's like the project is too big to be able to address that in a rapid way through code.
Yeah, well, and the human brain is really bad at large scale systems thinking. Mm-hmm. Like thinking through all of the logic and everything, it's incredibly difficult to do, and so. A big reason we did the vertical slice was we have all these documents explaining the different systems, right? Here's how the crafting is going to work. Here's how this is going to work. Here's how that's going to work. And I've been collaborating with Sam on all this stuff and getting a sense for all these things. And at the beginning of this week, we were talking about kind of next steps. I was like, you know, it's cool that we have all these, but I still don't know what this game is. Like, We have documents that are a pile of systems, but what is it going to be like to sit down and play this game for the first time? What am I going to do? What am I going to see? What am I going to experience?
Well, you know what this reminds me of though is we talked to Levelhead players who ask for advice about how to build good levels, right? And we say, don't draw it. What you need to do is just list the experiences that the player is going to have because they can
tell
only
a story.
Have – Exactly. They could only have one experience at a time, right? Are they walking right now? Because they can't walk and also be in a boss fight. Like those aren't two sort of experiential things. So what are they doing moment to moment? And can you get a clear picture of that? Because as soon as you can, the whole rest of it kind of shakes out and answers itself. And you could also find obvious holes just by reviewing that whole process. And so, I think you're absolutely right that it's sort of going from this point of saying, okay, here's all the tools we have available, right? I've spec'd out all these design tools, right? If you want to think about it like that, what experiences can those and what those experiences are that can be created? So sort of building a dictionary, and now it's time to actually write a story with those things to check in on the dictionary and see if it's actually correct, right?
Yeah. So the vertical slice has been super cool and interesting. If any of our listeners are in the process of kind of coming up with their own game design ideas, just try this. You think you know what your game is gonna be. Write tell a story of what the player's doing in the first hour of the game, and try to get real specific.
How would this differ from a design doc in sort of the classical sense?
It differs from a design doc because it doesn't actually cover all of the scenarios. It covers a player's linear experience, right? So kind of like, Adam, when you were talking about the player enters the room. If they interact with this, this happens. If they interact with that, that happens. So that's a design doc because it's covering all of the possibilities of how the system works, right? But a vertical slice is the player walks in. They see all these different things. They walk over and they start interacting with this thing. Something happens, blah, blah, blah. Then the player leaves, right? We're not even covering all the other stuff that might have happened in that room. We're just talking about what this player decided to do and what the game does sort of in response to those things. So it's more about just trying to visualize what you think a typical starting player's experience is and making sure that based on your understanding of the game systems, which have already been established in a design doc, that everything actually works the way that you thought it was going to work without necessarily writing a bunch of code.
Yeah, so it's a user story and sort of the agile software.
Yeah, that's think about it. Yep. Exactly.
Just a fucking long one.
A long user story. typically in agile, user stories are like the player can – or the user
– I can save.
Can click this button to save or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, they're much more concise.
Wow, great story. Cool story, bro, as they say.
Well, because they're focused on individual programmable features, right, which is not the same thing as the higher level. Here's what the whole experience of using like the software looks like from top to bottom.
Yeah.
So that's been a super cool tool, and I'm very excited about it. And it also has made me a lot more pumped about the game because I feel like I can see it. Like, I feel like I can see what this game is actually going to shape
into. Yeah. Well, the next phase of this is that Sam will start putting together an actual map of the locations. Just a rough sketch, right? But this is something we found too. We were playing D&D a few weeks ago. My wife was DMing, and we found that the moment we had something to look at, so we were all kind of talking through stuff and she was describing where we were on this train, right? And we're all kind of like mentally trying to keep track of what's going on. And then Sam just like dashed this like shitty sketch of a train, right? As fast as he could.
That was beautiful. I don't know. But
I think given the tools you had at your disposal, it was excellent.
It was pretty good.
It actually bent in like – it was like a C-shaped train.
Yeah, because he kind of ran out of space.
So I bent it around so it had seven cargo containers.
But even with that, like rapidly, like best you could in a moment rendition, all of a sudden it made everything click and be a lot easier. And so then the next time when we had the next session, my wife had prepared a whole bunch of extra stuff and like gotten all these cool assets and actually like structured the trains very intentionally with put the characters in there, like all the NPCs and stuff, so that now all of a sudden when we played it, it was such a different experience. And so we were kind of thinking about that with respect to this vertical slice, which is the storytelling initially is really useful to kind of like start thinking your way through it. But you quickly run into that limitation, which is that since the game is taking place in a physical space and you need to be telling a story through it, then you don't really necessarily want to just have like pictures of like scenes that a person will experience as they go through, because the picture is at such a brief moment in the story, right?
Yeah, it's a snapshot. It's
just a snapshot. It's more useful is actually having the text description to really just fully describe the story, like, as if you're reading a novel, while having alongside that the imagery of the physical locations you're walking through and where stuff is. And so you can get a sense of like, how long did it take to get from here to there? What kind of stuff is in my way? Just what is going on in this space? So that's the kind of next phase that could be really interesting to see how that changes things.
Yeah. It's been a ton of fun to kind of shake these things out. And I have been able to do a few additional concept pieces. They're all sort of just in this rough, very early stages as far as, slapping stuff down to get a sense of either scale for things or what the characters might look like, all this other stuff, which I have to say has been fascinating because I haven't gotten to do art in a while since I've been purely just doing a lot of this design focused stuff. And holy shit, is it a rusted tool that I have at this point for drawing? So that also spoke to me in a different way, which is like, okay, so I need to be doing some art every day because like some new visual artwork every day, not just sort of, putting marketing stuff together or whatever else, because I need to be at the top of my game once we actually get into legit viz dev development on this thing, and it's going to require being a little more warmed up than I was a couple days ago when I got back.
Yeah. Yeah, the viz dev is going to be laying the foundational elements for what this game is going to look like. And you don't want to be rusty at that time.
Well, this always happens, right? I mean, you do – I think especially when you're on a small team, it is the case. Like you'll tend to be wearing a lot of hats, right? And it's an interesting point that like while you're not wearing a particular hat, the other one is just sort of deteriorating.
The moths are eating it,
right? Yeah, the moths are eating it. And like it's only once you put it on and you actually spend time essentially patching it. While it's on your head, and then I think this will be one of the dangers heading into this project is figuring out how to balance those things, especially in my case, since I'll flip between basically the design storytelling and the art side of things to make sure that I can keep everything keep all those plates spinning enough or those hats spinning to keep all the moths at bay. So it's going to be a bit of a
that's the metaphor. You just spin those hats. All right. Well, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. All right. Highest upvoted question comes from Tim Conceivable, who says, Sam, could you share with us some of the inspiration behind the designs of the various enemies and things in Levelhead? GR18 reminds me a bit of Eve from WALL-E, and I've wondered if that might have been a possible inspiration.
So I think the reality is when I was making our core character, GR18, as well as a bunch of the earlier artwork, most of it was done before I started like being actually interested in doing art essentially halfway into Levelhead. It's a dumb, horrifying thing to say, but it's true. And so, GR18 was still made with that previous sort of method where it was just kind of like, really just drawn some shit without any reference, without having been like, what is this? Why, etc. And actually the first version looked like a CRTV, like one of those old, do you guys remember that? It was like, he was just a box essentially. Yep. And it was so hideous. I looked back at the artwork the other day. I was like, good God. Yeah. I was like, this is good enough. And then, so I think what happened was I just sort of stumbled on a lot of it. Again, has to do with the constraints of the game. Like when I think it's one of the fascinating things about doing art, just directly in a production sense without doing any concepts first. It's one of the nice things, honestly, it does give you is it forces you to be playing into the constraints of the game code itself, which in our case was a platformer, which means that the character needs to basically fill/be inside of a single grid space.
Yeah, the character needs to fit in things.
Yeah. So you got to make sure it looks like it can fit in stuff, which basically means that it has to fit inside of a single grid space, roughly.
Yes.
And so that was honestly the major part. And then when you look at that fact, like you just don't have a lot of room to put the whole like other body parts. So it was only natural that the character ended up turning into just a body or a head, with arms and legs sort of just attached Kirby style onto it at the end of the day. But I will say there was not – I wish there was inspiration. I wish there was foresight that I could explain, but there was not. Not at all.
But in hindsight, it looks a bit like Eve. So that's, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just that's con. Nice. All right. Next question comes from Digital Wizard, who said – there's no A in it, so that's – that's where the pronunciation comes from. Seth, in your 2018 GDC talk, you say plans are bad and you shouldn't do them. I find planning keeps happening without me thinking about it. How do you keep chaos plentiful to combat the planning? Mm. What do you do to sprinkle chaos into your day? So part of the reason that I said plans are bad was – which I still believe to be true is that – if you believe that your plan is accurate, then you're wrong, right? So plans are essentially attempting to predict the future and then being wrong about it, which implies that there is always chaos happening in your day all the time. Mm-hmm. So even though you might be planning, that doesn't keep the world from doing whatever it is already going to do to ruin your plans.
And if you hold to the plan despite what the world is doing, that's where the problem comes in. But actually planning, which is sort of – so scenario planning is one way of saying here's the kind of chaos that I can see. Now here are the things I'm going to do for each kind of chaos that happens, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
generally a very useful exercise. But you can't push it out too far because once you compound chaos on top of chaos, then you get exponentially too many sorts of paths you can go down. And nobody has enough time to figure out what you would do in all of those consequences. So it's all about trying to figure out what realistically are the sort of shortest term scenarios you're going to find yourself in and being prepared for those. And if you're trying to work on a project, if you already know – so you can plan a big project if there's no reason to think that the project is going to change as you implement it, right? Which is pretty rare. And the bigger a project gets, the more and more likely it is that it's going to have to change. You're going to discover things that you didn't know ahead of time. You're going to the world around you will have changed, causing you just to need to make a new thing. Who knows what, right? Yep. And so the idea of this idea of plans being bad is the fact of chaos. And so you're fine. If you find yourself making plans, and as you're saying, like on accident, like you can't help yourself, right? You still should be making plans. Absolutely. It's that you have to do it while respecting that the world is chaos.
Mm-hmm. Chaos needs to be part of the plan, I would say.
I think there's another point here, which is that there's a couple different kinds of plans. We talk about this. So I think my favorite one that actually I feel like works no matter what is just the turbo high level sort of core response that you would like to have, or the core thing that you're trying to make. And so what I mean by that is like picking something that is so big that no amount of chaos in the world would actually change your approach on that level. So in game design, there's a lot of these ideas as far as you call them pillars, right? So a game design pillar, which is just to say, we don't know what the exact look of this is going to be, but one of the pillars of this game is that there are like these shared pet experiences or something like that, right? We're not exactly sure the implementation of that, but that is going to be in there because that is what this game is in some way. And in some way, I feel like those sorts of plans are, because they're not so specific, they aren't quite as fragile. So we talk about this vertical slice concept actually. I think it's an interesting way to think about this because the whole point of it is to get as specific as possible so that we can essentially pass it through this simulation of what will actually happen when we go to build the thing, and then as cheaply as possible, change our plan. And sometimes basically like where we've been getting to with this pre-production process is starting at that super high level and saying like, what's this about on a core level that we just want it to be about no matter what happens, all the way down to say, okay, here's the specific details that match with that whole thing. What aspect of this is actually now wrong because of, you know, chaos or whatever else. And so you can kind of figure out the different – there's almost like different tiers of planning,
I guess. Yeah, or as you're doing it, you ask which components of this are the most subject to what kinds of chaos, right?
Yes.
So if part of your design includes, let's say, monetization with the question of, is this thing going to be free to play with like something cosmetic unlocks? Is this going to be – or is it going to be just a thing that you buy? What is this thing going to be, right? And – That informs your how many aspects of the design have to be. And so then you can – if you don't know what that's going to be yet, because let's say you're in our position. You're like, okay, we're going to make a game for next several years. We don't know what the market's going to look like when we go to launch it. So we want to make that decision as late as we can get away with, right? And so you take all the things that aren't impacted, at least in a specific way, by a choice like that, that you know you can fix, like Sam said, like – pets are going to be a key system, right? And you could just like put a pin in those and just say here are my anchor points for like what this thing is going to be, and then you let everything else that causes the chaos to unfold guide you as you then start to put it together, where the things are the most chaotic or the least inside your control or whatever. You try to make your plans so that those get to come later, so that. Mm-hmm. You get to sort of have already accumulated the chaos that leads up to it before you actually pin that thing. Because many of these things, once you actually set them down, once you pin them, they're just stuck that way now. So if you pin something too early and everything else is now dependent on the way that you did that, and it turns out that that's not going to work for some chaos reason that you didn't predict, then it can be very hard or impossible to revert a decision like
that. So I guess to summarize, in the short term, go ahead. Figure out what you're going to do this week. Figure out what you're going to do this weekend. That's fine. As the timeline gets longer, try to plan as little as possible and stay loose. Stay flexible because you have no idea what's coming.
Yeah. If you had any plans last year for this year, You're not doing it.
Guess what?
Yep.
Yeah. Didn't see this coming, did you?
Yeah.
Did you, buddy?
This is one of those things that's so, it's like so yep. big that it literally destroyed all plants, right? There's no plant that survived COVID.
I saw on the news today that Disney reported their first quarterly loss in 20 years.
Yep.
Shit.
Yeah. So that wasn't part of the plan. I'm sure. And honestly, even although thinking really, about, you know,
nobody what? Should just continue to do better for that long of a period of time, you know, like
that's pretty remarkable. But
you know, they probably were going to regardless. So, but I mean, even, you know, hearing from employees at Valve, and they talk about how despite having data, sales data and engagement data and analytics galore for thousands and thousands, or yeah, I guess now probably 100,000 games or how many they have.
It's tens of thousands, definitely.
Tens of thousands of games over now more than a decade, probably 16 years. Even Valve cannot look at a game and be like, this is going to do well or this is going to do poorly. They will not comment because they're like, yeah, we just don't know. We can't predict it at all.
That was
all.
The whole reason they opened the store up to everybody was because they just said
there's only too the many
market
times.
Knows what the market
yeah.
wants.
Yeah.
So to let only everything people, hit the market yeah. and see what sticks.
Yeah. And so if an organization like that with that level of sophistication and that level of access to all of the information you could possibly need in order to like make a successful game, then makes a game like Artifact, which did not do well and people did not really go for, right? It just goes to show that that it's just really hard to predict
yeah.
pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. So do your best. Stick to your principles. Stick to your pillars. And
but
try
don't
to
stick
keep things,
to your plan.
But yeah, keep things flexible. All right. Next question comes from C. Price. As an aspiring indie dev, I'm curious about the process for contracting voice actors for your games. Where did you find Amy for Levelhead, and what was your selection process like? Did she provide her own recording equipment, or did you have to rent a studio? And what was the feedback process like? Was there any back and forth on voice lines?
Oh, this is fun. So voice is a thing that I'm really keen on it, especially I think it adds a bunch of extra flair to your games, and certainly I feel like it just kind of punches the quality up. It's one of those things. If it's done well, then it's like, it just adds another level of professionalism.
It also punches the file size up.
Yes, there's a bunch of ramifications for it. It's kind of wild, especially when you look at 2D games in particular, because like we don't have – our games just aren't that big in terms of their memory footprint. Sound, I guess how much of the file size is actually just sound, Seth, for Levelhead, do you recall?
About two-thirds.
Yeah, so think about that. Like two-thirds of Levelhead is actually just the music, these voiceover recordings and sound effects and stuff.
Yep.
So there's some funny considerations there to be aware of before going in. And the other is that it is pricey. It is an expensive thing when you're actually having professionals do it. In terms of, you know, you might get, you know, what, a couple hundred words for, you know, essentially a couple hundred bucks, I guess is like the easy way to think about it. And so we use a service called Voice123. And this is one that I know a lot of other game devs use and just a lot of people who have to contract out voice work, because you can post a script and then kind of set some parameters for it where it's like, oh yeah, this is a woman's voice. We want it to be in this language or with this particular accent or a couple different accents. And then people will actually just sort of, they'll just throw in samples based on the text you provide. You provide sample text. And then you listen through those and see if you find one that you like. You could also invite specific people. And then go back and forth with them about price, sign your contract, and you're ready to go. So the selection process is actually pretty simple. It only took a couple of days once we got the script and stuff figured out. And then most professional voice actors, what you're also paying for. So when I say it's pricey, the reason it's pricey is because most of these voice actors and actresses do the whole production kit for you. And they have their own studio and stuff. So you're not paying for studio time. You're not paying for additional production on the
sound. Well, you are
sound
paying
fest.
For it, just not separately.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's good. Come yeah. on. It's built in. It's bundled in. And so that's everything from essentially a thing that I didn't even know was a thing, but removing breaths from their voice work is actually a thing that nearly all these professional voice folks will do, because in a video game, it's actually really weird. And we actually had this the first one we got back. I forgot to ask her for it. And hearing someone breathe in a voiceover, just pay attention to this when you listen to it. It doesn't happen. Even though it happens literally all the time if you're talking to a person. You can always hear when they're
– breathing in audio is like the opposite of blinking in visual, right? Like if somebody doesn't blink, you're like, what the fuck is happening? but if someone breathes though and you hear it, then you're like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, yeah.
Weirdly, I'm not supposed to hear this.
It was super weird.
Well, I think it's because of the fact that when you are speaking to somebody in normal – like at a normal human distance in person – you don't really hear their breaths.
That's true. It is amplified.
It's the mic. Yeah, it's the microphone that does it.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So yeah, that was a little weird. But yeah, the only back and forth, we just did a couple of back and forths. If there was a particular line where I was like, oh, you know, maybe punch it up in this way. So essentially, what we did is we shared a Google Doc with the whole script. I highlighted all of her lines and then also added comments about sort of, you know, kind of like a directorial thing with it. And some people you can actually like Skype with them while they do their thing and provide, you know, live feedback while they do a couple lines. In our case, I was just like, go for it. You know, you have an awesome voice. It's super fun. Just be a weirdo and we'll see what happens.
So we also do this with the Chinese version of the trailer for Crashlands when we launched it in China. And I remember we all gathered around to hear the samples that came in through that service, and it was so fun and hilarious to hear, because of course that was that over the top trailer originally in Sam's voice, so that was the reference
with screaming, screaming
and the whole thing, and so it was just so fun to hear people's rendition of that in Chinese. It was a blast. Getting to pick those up.
It's also one of those things, kind of like this whole idea of vertical slice, whatever else, where hearing a professional do these things makes. It just makes stuff really cool. Like, I don't know. Like, you know, I'll write a script. I'll be like, oh, yeah, this is like, well, you know, we'll sort of run around the office and be like, oh, this sounds funny. But then hearing someone actually do it for real is just a very different experience. So
it makes it real.
Yeah. Yeah. So Amy Smith was our voice actress. She did a fantastic job. And it was very, very fun to kind of have our back and forth with her over that time.
So Voice 123, you said, is the name of the thing. All right. Well, I hope that answers question. Think it does, but yeah, it is something that you're going to get what you pay for. Be willing to support these voice artists, and you got to lay down the cash, you know? So, all right, well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything you could possibly want. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.